Disclaimer: the views and opinions expressed by the participants in this cave are not the views of AnimeNewsNetwork.com. Enjoy the show. In a cave. From Los Angeles, this is the AnCast. I'm Zach Birchie. Thanks for listening. We've got a little bit of a different show format this week. Both of my hosts are out of town. Justin's recovering from Singapore, and Bamboo's out of town for Thanksgiving, obviously. So doing things a little bit differently this time. First, I've got a segment recorded with Justin while he was in Singapore, so it's about 15 minutes of that. Then I bring in Bradley Meek from Anime 3000, just to talk a little bit about some shows we've been watching, get a little anime in there. Then we'll have a short break, and then I'll bring in Deb from About.com. So I hope you like the show. We'll be back to normal next week with Justin in the co-host chair. So hope you like it. Here's Justin from fabulous Singapore. So, Justin, you're still out there in Singapore.
Yep, I'm coming back tomorrow.
Tomorrow, Monday the 23rd?
Your time, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, here it's Tuesday. Tuesday afternoon.
Yeah, this show is going to go out Wednesday afternoon, so people will have something to listen to on the ride to Grandma's house for Thanksgiving. So we should just put that into context. You just did two great reviews for us that I'm really happy and extremely jealous that you got to see these movies. Evangelion 2.0 and Summer Wars.
They were both amazing.
Yeah, spoiler, you really liked both of them, which is, I'm so jealous. So which one, I mean, obviously they're not to be compared. They're obviously totally different.
Right, yeah, they're completely different. I desperately need both of them on Blu-ray, like tomorrow.
Yeah, it sounded to me like you thought Summer Wars was really kind of a game changer.
It is. I mean, he's basically, I mean, people are calling him the new Miyazaki for a reason.
Yeah.
Hosoda, the director. But unlike Miyazaki, he seems to actually like people and doesn't think kids these days are just up to no good.
You know, it's funny because his demeanor sort of, or at least what I've heard of his demeanor, reminds me of the guy who directed Kanagi and Haruhi. That's the same guy, right?
I don't remember off the top of my head.
Or Lucky, it was like Kanagi and Lucky Star. But he had like a really good attitude about the fans and what he was making. Like he seemed to connect with the otaku audience, not in a pandering, like, oh, here you go, you idiots, kind of a way. Like he genuinely appreciated his craft. And it sounds to me like this guy, I mean, you interviewed him, right?
Oh yeah, repeatedly.
Right. How'd that go?
It was kind of a pain because, all of the interviews were on stage. And of course, because it was, you know, sponsored by two Japanese mega conglomerates, I had to get all the questions approved beforehand. And they were worried about the timing. And he was like, oh, I'm a talker. Fewer questions is better. Oh, we only have half hour? No more than two or three. So I'd go up there with three questions and we'd blow through them in 5 minutes.
Yep.
I'm like, damn it. So I have to like mentally shuffle through the piles in my mind and try to figure out, you know, what ones I had excised earlier. It was, they were hard interviews, but they were fun.
Oh, that's cool. So, I mean, that movie was really, really well received in Japan not by a wide audience, I don't think, or was it?
No, it wasn't a huge blockbuster, but it did respectable numbers, and it's such a crowd pleaser, this movie.
Yeah.
It's not challenging viewing. It's fun. It's something you can, you know, relax to. But if you want to analyze it and if you want to explore, you know, deeper meanings, they're there. And in my opinion, that's kind of the ultimate.
Yeah, that's the best, you know, a movie with depth that's fun to watch.
Right.
That's really the best of both worlds. Something you can sink your teeth into that doesn't challenge you as a viewing experience. Like, it's not boring.
And yet, it's visually incredibly inventive. I thought it had looked a lot like, Murakami and the super flat stuff, but I asked him about it on stage, and he was like, yeah, a lot of people have said that, and no, I didn't really intend that. But on the other hand, the guy did direct Super Flat Monogram, so it's probably just ingrained in his artistic style now.
Yeah, he and Murakami are, I wouldn't say contemporaries. Murakami's been doing it for much longer.
Oh yeah, well, Hosoda's been around a while. I mean, he was at Toei long enough ago to work on Slam Dunk. So
okay.
Yeah, I mean, his directorial debut were the were two of the Digimon Adventure movies.
Oh God. Are you going to go back and check those out
now? Way
better
than the others, but by the time we got the Digimon Adventure stuff, it was all hacked together into one big glob, so no one could tell them apart.
So for Evangelion now, I mean, you and I both sort of had similar feelings about the first film, that it was just too similar to the original. So was that really just a big tease?
I think it was. I think basically it went in, so it was, that movie solely exists, A, to recap what they didn't want to really change, mm-hmm. and B, so you went into the summer movie going, okay, well, let's see if they change anything, yeah. Z. And then you basically, it's like walking right into the front end of a bazooka.
That's really cool, though. That's what I really wanted to see. And I got to wonder if, I wonder what the mass fan reaction, I wonder what people are going to think.
It's been very positive as far as the Japanese release. Like, I have yet to talk to anyone that doesn't like it.
Wow.
It's, I mean, if you're not an Eva fan, your mileage may vary. Honestly, I think many more people will be able to relate to Shinji now that he, you know, he's much of a more of a go-getter. He's not, he can even stand up to his father without going to the fetal position.
Huh. That's a big character change.
It sounds like it, but he's still the same old Shinji in other ways. I mean, he's a lot easier to relate to now. Like, it's a lot easier to genuinely like the kid.
That's cool. That's a big character change, but it was also such a huge complaint from the first series.
Exactly. And frankly, everyone is much more likable. Even Asuka, I don't want to set her on fire as badly anymore.
You know, and at the same time, I feel a little bad for Anno, just because people are going to use this as an excuse to psychoanalyze him to death, comparing this and the character's emotional maturity in this versus the original.
There's no denying that it's an incredibly personal work.
I just, I feel kind of bad for him, because people are going to assume they know so much about him, which maybe they do, you know? I don't know.
You put yourself out there, and that's what happens. It's just part of the game. And if he's not used to it by this point, I mean, it was, at least this time, people will like him instead of wanting to torch him.
Yeah, no, hopefully they'll like him. So tell us about the convention. How was that? How did all that go?
It was surprising in a lot of ways. I mean, I enjoyed it, although the consumer event, I was, you know, I kind of made me want to flee. Mm-hmm. It felt like, it only made me want to flee because I've just been to so many cons. It was really, really, really packed, and it wasn't that big, and it was a commuter con. So it was kind of like, if you could imagine a combination of New York Anime Fest, mm-hmm. and the consumer days of Tokyo Anime Fair.
Ugh, that sounds kind of awful. So it's just like wall-to-wall people?
It wasn't quite as bad as Tokyo Anime Fair. In fact, it wasn't anywhere near as bad as Tokyo Anime Fair. But it was much smaller than I would ever expect for a convention of this size to be, this many people.
In terms of the space?
Yeah, in terms of the space. It was two big halls that weren't really separated with a big wall, and one was for the loud, you know, concerts and panels, and one was the exhibition floor, and that was that.
Oh, that reminded, that was sort of like some of the smaller cons, like, what was that one?
Anime Next.
Kind
of like that for a few years.
Yes, Anime Next, where they would just have like a big walled off space in the middle of a big room, and they would hold panels and events in there, and it was totally like loud.
Yeah, it was really loud. But, you know, people were having a good time. And, you know, you forget with cons like this that they're commuter cons. So people aren't hanging out there for the entire weekend. They're in and out, you know, probably either in a few hours or, you know, they might go one day and not the next. So that's something to keep in mind when people go, hey, this space isn't big enough to hold that many people. There's no way.
It's, you know, because there's never that many people in there at the same time.
Right, exactly. It's not 45,000 people in there all at once. It's 45,000 people in and out over the course of the weekend.
Sort of the opposite problem San Diego Comic-Con has, where there are 140,000 people in the room at the same time.
You know, I've never been, and I'm so not excited to go ever.
You're so going to go next year.
Probably.
I don't see how you could avoid it at this point.
Yeah, I'll probably get pressured into it at some point. One thing about Singapore, though, the fan scene here is really incredibly vibrant, and I kind of expected that, but they're still smarting really badly from the Odex incident.
Really? Now, you mentioned in the blog people were literally burning Odex and the DVDs in the street.
It wasn't quite that bad. It was, I was getting conflicting reports, and finally I met up with this guy, Sean, who actually had this giant collection of newspaper clippings from the entire Odex incident.
Mm-hmm.
And basically, it's It's kind of like a boiled down version of the RIAA and their lawsuits against the consumers. And it was a much bigger deal for Odex because they're a much smaller company, and they so didn't have their shit together. They really ended up just getting completely flayed by the media and ended up losing a couple significant court cases. The thing is about Odex is that, you know, it felt even worse because Odex started out as one of those janky games retailers that has a bunch of VHS bootlegs. Remember those?
Yep. Games and James in Chinatown.
Yep. Exactly. So, you know, it was kind of, they eventually started licensing stuff and putting stuff out on VCDs, and, you know, they really put some effort into it, and it was really, I can completely understand, even if I sympathize with Odex for wanting to defend their rights, I completely understand how it completely felt like a total slap in the face of the fan community, especially because, you know, they were doing the same thing with the recording industry, like suing 9-year-olds.
Oh my God. Is there any faster way to just get what's left of your consumer base to turn on you faster than suing kids who download shit?
No. I mean, my favorite part about this whole thing is that I met their lawyer. Mm-hmm. I met Odex's lawyer for all of this, yeah. And he learned nothing.
Oh, he was totally still like, we got to sue people. We got to put people in jail for downloading.
Yep.
And I hate to, part of me is kind of like, well, there are laws and the laws should be followed. And, you know, you can't just laugh in the face of it. If it's illegal, you shouldn't do it. There should be no punishment for committing what is a crime, but it's never going to work. It's totally impractical, unenforceable law. And when you do selectively, like, you can't selectively enforce that law because you're going to wind up putting some kid in jail for downloading an anime.
Let's face it, there is a huge disconnect between how it looks from a content provider's point of view and how it looks from a consumer point of view. I completely understand, as like a 15-year-old kid looking at something on the internet, how, you know, the difference between that and reading the New York Times online seems really, really, really thin. Mm-hmm. You know?
Yeah. No. That's completely.
So even if they did prosecute someone, I mean, there's a huge risk of the violation being grossly inferior to the punishment.
Yeah. Exactly. I mean, that anything more than a small fine seems like way too much. And even then, what are you doing? The only reason to do that is to make an example of somebody.
Yeah.
You're not really, justice is not necessarily being served there. Well, it's not really about justice.
I had a really great sit down with Mr. Katakawa, owner of Katakawa, and he had a number of interesting thoughts on the matter. I'll leave it to our readers to read the interview when we post it.
Yeah.
But he's a really smart guy, and I think there's starting to be a consensus that if the fan sub problem is ever going to go away, the legal means of watching something not only has to match the experience, but be able to beat it in some way.
Right. Yeah, that's pretty, I think that's pretty common, pretty common sentiment.
Well, it seems like common sense, but it took years to get to this.
Yeah, it did.
Years to get to this point. Come on.
So I feel like you should talk a little bit about the food in Singapore.
Okay.
If I
twist
don't,
my arm.
Like, I feel like I've been really suppressing the food thing, and I, you know, here's your couple of minutes to talk about food. Go ahead.
Okay. Well, let's start at this hotel. First of all, they put me up in this gorgeous hotel. It's the Mandarin Oriental.
Okay. Well, that means nothing to anybody, but all right.
Okay. Well, it's a 5-star hotel.
Okay.
By Asian standards, which are even higher. And they have this breakfast buffet that is ridiculous. It is the size of Todai.
Yes, but can you make your own waffles?
Yes.
Yeah, right. You can do that at a Days Inn, though, so. Anyway.
Or you can make your own ramen.
Oh, well, that's it.
And there's congee, and there's Indian food, and there's prosciutto, and there's ridiculous, you know, juices from, like, 5 different kinds of tropical fruit. It is a beautiful thing, and on the plane ride back, when it hits that time of day when I would normally eat there and I can't, I will just start wailing like a baby. So that's just the hotel. We haven't even gotten out of the hotel yet. 5 blocks from here is a gigantic hawker market. Mm-hmm. And what these are, they're basically huge outdoor food courts. At night, on the weekends, it spills over into a street that they close down, and it becomes an all-night beer and kebab barbecue party.
Sweet.
And inside there's, you know, sushi, there's Korean, there's amazing Chinese, there's dim sum day and night, there's really great halal food. There's, I mean, and a lot of like local specialties. Like there's a prawn and satay sauce dish, and Hainanese chicken, which is the food here is to die for. It is to absolute die for, and that is why I will vacation here at every possible opportunity, because I just want to buy a whole lot of this food and roll in it. I'm putting it in. I'm bringing it all back to the hotel. I'm dumping it all in the bathtub, and I'm laying in there.
Kind of disgusting, but okay. Okay, awesome. Well, it's great you had a good time, and you know, we're all looking forward to having you back on the show regularly next week.
Yeah, and I gotta thank the guys who invited me, the Animation Asia Conference and the Anime Festival Asia. These guys, they're great guys, and it's one of those things that, you know, they work really, really, really hard at their fandom, and because they're not in North America or Japan, no one notices them, and I could see that they've kind of just been aching to just get someone to notice. And, well, flying me out there is a good way to get me to notice.
Yeah, well, and our readers to notice.
It's great stuff. They're great people, and I felt truly welcome here, so I'm really grateful.
Cool. All right, man. Well, you know, have a fun flight back.
Thank you.
Yeah, all right. Okay, with me now is Bradley C. Meek. You prefer Brad or Bradley?
Bradley, please.
Okay. Bradley from themanime.org and anime3000.com, correct?
Yes.
What's your title at those places?
I'm just a staff writer on both.
Okay, and so tell us a little bit about those sites. Start with Them Anime, which I know started as an anime club at ASU in Arizona that I had some interesting experiences with.
Yeah, compared to the rest of the internet with a lot of new blogs, we are ancient. We are dinosaurs. We've been around for at least since 2003 in one form or another. Them started out as a way for the science fiction geekery anime club, Them, to post reviews of what they had recently watched together as a group. And it evolved from there. The site became fairly popular, and it was one of the first to extensively have a review database, and we still have an absolutely huge review database with opinions on a lot of anime going on, especially the ones from the early 2000s, late 90s. If it was released, chances are pretty good we have a review for it.
Right. Yeah, that's an old database. That's been around since the late 90s, right?
I don't know, late 90s. As far as I know from archive.org, I've seen our website as it looked in 2003, but they mention in their oldest updates that there seemed to have been a previous version that I haven't found.
Well, I know the club has been around at ASU for at least 10, 12 years. It's been around for a long time.
You would know more about that than I would.
Yeah, well, I mean, I was president of the anime club in college, and I lived in Tucson, and they were in Phoenix, and we occasionally cross-pollinated, but that was at least 1998, so it's an old club. But that's cool. So what about Anime 3000? This is sort of an up-and-coming site. I know I've been on Sean's show a few times.
Yeah, anime3000.com is a startup venture by Sean, who is the host of the Anime 3000 podcast. Let me first cover what the podcast is. It's kind of like the Meet the Press of the anime world. Sean brings on usually three different people of some aspect of anime fandom, sits them down and interviews them for roughly an hour about some topic in the anime world. It's a very enlightening podcast. It's kind of like what ANN Cast has done right now and what the Right Stuff podcast has done, but without all the advertisements.
Yeah. I would say it strives to be the Meet the Press. I wouldn't say it is the Meet the Press of the
anime getting there.
World.
They're getting there.
Yeah, it's a good show. It's a good show.
The website, we're a little bit up in the air about what we want to do, but we're very ambitious, I'll put it that way, and we want to create a site. We've noticed that a lot of anime blogs right now are divided into kind of little tribes. There's the Moe tribe, there's the Old School tribe, there's the We Hate Everything and Everyone But Ourselves tribe. There's all sorts of places, and Sean wanted to be very holistic in his approach to anime and the anime fandom on Anime 3000. We're working out right now what we want to do, but expect the site in the future to be very meta, not only about the fans, but we'll also be very much about promoting other bloggers and other websites.
Well, good luck with that. I know that there isn't really a good clearinghouse spot for the kind of fan press, I want to say. Because it's sort of what podcasts have kind of become, is the fan press. They're not pros. They do it for fun. They do it in their spare time. But there's no one place you can go to get to find, you know, shows you might like or blogs you might want to read. You know,
that's becoming our goal.
Yeah. Well, that's a good goal. So the reason I had you on the show is because Justin's out of town. Bamboo's out of town because it's Thanksgiving week. And I wanted someone to you know, let me know what they've been watching and you know, chat a little bit about what I've been watching. So what have you seen? What have you been up to lately? What anime have you seen lately?
Well, just recently I started watching Kurozuka. Kurozuka is a 2007 anime by Madhouse, directed by the same guy who did Death Note, about a shogunate who is on the run from a mysterious group of very evil people. He happens upon a house that's abandoned in the middle of the woods in Japan, and there is a very young lady who lives there. She graciously takes them in, but forbids the man from visiting her room, which is in the back of this large mansion. Of course, he breaks the rule and discovers that she is a vampire who feeds on the undead. The interesting thing about it is that she's a very polite and very kindly kind of vampire. You know how geisha act toward their clients. There's a way that Japanese women act in classical Japanese literature. She acts a lot like that. Not exactly demurring to everything they say, but they're very polite, very devoted. Mm-hmm. Would be the way I describe her. There is an evil group that I forget their name offhand who are trying to get their hands on the secret to immortality, and of course, she has that secret that is in her blood. The anime quickly becomes a very delirious journey through time and space as they keep running from this group who keeps finding them and kidnapping or killing them. They keep being resurrected. It's hard to follow right now, but it's an anime that's very pleasant to kind of simmer in. The other one I'm watching is one that you had mentioned before, which was Story of Saiyan Koku. It's basically the short story of a lady in a...
Yeah, I know what it's about. I've seen it.
Oh, okay. Yeah, then I don't need to recap it for you. But I kind of have mixed feelings about this one. I started off very enthusiastic, and that enthusiasm has waned. A lot of the characters seem very static,
yeah.
And the hijinks are kind of predictable. I'm hoping that once they get into a stronger story instead of the short arcs that they've been doing, it'll be better. But there's also this complex political underpinning in the show that I've had a hard time following, and that's been frustrating.
Yeah, I got through the first couple of discs and put it down, not because I wasn't enjoying it, just because something else came along. I'll finish it out eventually, but I'm pretty much in agreement with you. I started out like, wow, this is really great, and then it's like, okay,
it's something I want to finish.
It
has promise, so I'll finish it out. And I also promised Sean I'd get a review in by the end of next week.
Yeah, I seriously doubt that they'll ever release the second season of that, so I'm sort of a little wary of getting too into it. And, you know, box set finishes out and there's another 40 episodes or whatever they have.
Right, and you're really chomping at the bit to finish this thing out.
Yeah, pretty much. So, I mean, would you give a recommendation to either of those? Or
Story of Saiyan Koku, I would recommend if you really like shoujo or harem aspects, kind of the reverse harem. But really, I think that right now it's only for hardcore Fujoshi fans would get the most enjoyment out of it. Mm-hmm. Kurozuka, I highly recommend, especially if you like very, very bloody anime. And that's very bloody. It's unlicensed in the United States right now, unfortunately.
Well, then you're killing the industry.
Yep.
All right. Okay. I have actually, speaking of killing the industry, I've been rewatching, mind you, Macross 7. A show.
Okay, I'm not familiar with the Macross franchise, so could you give me a quick summary of what this is?
Macross 7 is about an insufferable, self-absorbed rock musician named Basara, who has his own Valkyrie,
mm-hmm.
And there's a floating city called Macross 7. It's you know, this is humanity or whatever out in space, typical Macross storyline. And they're being invaded by the show's version of Zentradi. I'm usually watching this very late at night.
Is this the one where he controls the ship with his guitar?
The ship has a guitar controller, and he goes out. Every time there's a battle between humanity and the aliens, He goes out into battle and he shoots speaker pods into all of the mechs that are out there, the humans and the whatever the hell they're called.
So does he fight by going into a sweet riff?
And he sings. He says, you know, listen to my song and you'll know. Like you'll realize you don't have to fight. And he'll sing his poppy rock. It's very early 90s rock sounding. It could have been on the soundtrack to like a Bill and Ted movie, which is part of the reason I like it because I love Bill and Ted when I was a kid. I was really into that kind of music. And it's very, like, 90s rock. So he'll go out and he'll sing this stupid song. And everyone just gets kind of confused and irritated with him. And they're like, who the hell is this guy?
I wonder why.
They finish their fight, and everybody goes home, and he has no impact on anything. And the show is very sardonic, and it's very, I find it really entertaining. It's almost satire of the ridiculousness of the music will heal all wars theme that's in Macross, that's really heavy in Macross. There's an episode where Basara and the girl character, Melaine, get cast in a TV remake of Do You Remember Love? I mean, it's meta. It gets very meta. And the show is really silly. The music is great. It's a lot of fun. You cannot take it seriously. Like, it doesn't really take itself seriously. A lot of people hated it because it's not serious. Because Macross fans tend to be very like, oh, my anime, serious business. And this show is very silly, and intentionally so. It's I've got something like 20 episodes left, and then there's some movies and OVAs. One of the OVAs, which I never saw, I think it's called Macross 7 Dynamite, where Basara meets a Zentradi whaler who's like Captain Ahab, and he has like his Moby Dick of space that he's going after. Like I said, it's a silly ass show.
They have someone ham it up, right?
Yeah, it's a silly ass show. But I'm enjoying it. It's also super 90s. Like the whole look of it is very 90s. The animation's very, you know, 90s. And it's, if you can track it down and you have a sense of humor, you are looking to something that's sort of willfully dumb. Max 7's a lot of fun. Like I really enjoy it. The music is great. Like I said, it's good music. They had a very successful tour. The band that recorded all that stuff for a long time in Japan. It was much, much more popular in Japan. It'll never get licensed over here because the music rights are a nightmare. That's why it's never come out here, I've been told. I don't think it would sell if it did, but that's why it never came out, was because the music rights are insane. So it'll never come out, so I don't feel like I'm killing the industry by watching some... I mean, these are like VHS rips. It's pretty old school. But that, and I've been watching The Dragon Box, which is fun.
Is it everything you remembered?
I never watched the show when I was a kid.
Really?
This is actually the first time I've ever sat through Dragon Ball. And it's fun. I talked about this with Bamboo last week, but I did see Dragon Ball Kai. I saw like 2 or 3 episodes of that. That's way better.
Yeah, I've watched a little bit of Dragon Ball Kai, and I've been meaning to sit down and marathon most of it, presuming that Funimation doesn't license it in the near future.
Yeah, you know, that's one of the reasons I stopped, is because there's no way in hell Funimation isn't going to put that out, and we might get a Blu-ray release of it. I would love to watch Dragon Ball that way. That would be perfect. Dragon Ball
really,
Kai on Blu-ray.
I had thought that it'd be up in the air, because surely there's got to be a point where Funimation just goes too far and re-releases that show too many times and burns the casual fan, who I understand are the way that they're making a lot of money off of Dragon Ball.
Yeah, a lot of DBZ money. Dragon Ball Kai is so different, though. I mean, it's super condensed. It's proper widescreen. It's not that crappy forced widescreen they had on those other DVDs that really looked...
Will the casual fan know that?
Because
if I was just some random dude who really liked Dragon Ball but hates anime, which is what I've had some Dragon Ball fans tell me, then when I see Dragon Ball Kai on the shelves, I'll just kind of go, oh, they're just trying to exploit me for more money.
No, Dragon Ball Kai is different enough to sell it to those casual, because the casual fans bought those season box sets that are in the fake widescreen. Those sold like crazy. The Dragon Box is for the super hardcores who wanted that specific Japanese release. It is not really for the, I don't like anime, but I love Dragon Ball crowd. So this release is kind of, it's a little superfluous. Dragon Ball Kai, I think they can sell, especially if it comes out on Blu-ray, they can sell as the next generation Dragon Ball experience, I think. Because it's new and
chomping
shiny
at the bit to get some of it, so.
Yeah, it's new and shiny enough, I think, to where the casuals might give it a second look. Yeah, actually, that's about it. Thanks for being on and doing a quick segment with us. Hope you have a good holiday weekend, and we'll be back.
Can I plug something real quick?
Oh, sure, yes, please plug away.
Come January, Them Anime will be releasing our Best of the Decade list. These are actually going to be one from each of our writers and two from two very special guests, Jason Huff of The Anime Review and Chad Clayton, formerly of Anime Jump, and I think he still writes on a couple of other pop culture blogs.
I remember Chad.
Look forward to that. It'll be out starting the first week of January.
Oh, a Best of the Decade list. How original.
Oh. How original. Oh, come on. But you've got to make it. I'm totally chomping at the bit to write mine. I can't wait to get down and sort everything out obsessively.
Thanks for being on the show, and we'll be back after this break. My guest is Deb Aoki from MangaAbout.com, right?
Correct.
Okay. What's your title there? Is it just editor?
I mean, technically it's manga guide, but right. When I say manga editor, just...
Okay. So what does your job entail? What do you do over there?
So, well, basically as the manga editor for About.com, I'm supposed to give manga reviews, give manga news, as well as provide an introduction to manga to people who are new to it and want to learn.
Okay. Yeah, I checked the site out, and it seemed like it was sort of a cross between, you know, reviews and a little bit of blog stuff going on, and then just some basic information, that kind of thing.
Yeah, it's kind of been it's kind of evolved a little bit. I mean, About.com sites are mostly meant to teach people, like if they have a question about different subjects, then we're supposed to help answer it. But you know, as you kind of know, the manga world in the U.S. and Japan is so fast moving.
Yeah,
and you know, I think our readers really want to know what's new, what's happening. So, you know, sometimes I don't really work so much on the history of manga and the definitions and all that kind of stuff as much as I'd like to, because, you know, just keeping up with what's going on is really time consuming.
Yeah. I mean, I've been an anime guy pretty much my entire career. It's been brought to my attention lately that our manga coverage on ANN is, limited.
we don't
cover it nearly as much as we should. And we only really have one guy who is a manga guy. And only within the last couple of years have I sort of noticed that a manga critic and an anime critic are two very different creatures. Like, their jobs are very different. I mean, have you noticed that? Would you agree with that?
I'm learning that more and more. I guess our concerns are different, and I guess what we consume is different. I was really shocked to find out that a lot of anime fans don't read manga, even manga the influence for the anime series they like. That was kind of a mind blower for me, because I like both.
Yeah, I wonder if it's just a matter of convenience, because I know people read scanlations, but I hate reading things like a graphic novel on my computer. I still don't like doing that. And I guess scanlations only recently have become really a big problem. I guess
there's always going to be that. But I mean, because scanlations, you know, I mean, people kind of look the other way because it was a way of bringing titles that were never going to come to America to people's attention. But it's gotten to the point where scanlations are actually actively siphoning off sales.
Wow. Yeah. Are the scanlation groups as brazen as the fan sub kids are? Like, they're like,
some obviously do it out of love, and some have real principles about it. Like, if it gets licensed, they'll pull it down. Mm-hmm. But I see that less and less nowadays.
So it's turning into the kind of, yeah, we're sticking it to the man.
I don't know if sticking it to the man is the word for it, but just
not.
There's this excuse, like, I'm too poor to buy this, so I'm helping out other poor people.
Ugh, God.
You know what I mean? And I end up having these, you've seen me have these long, stupid discussions with people, like, you're hurting the artist.
Right.
The artist doesn't do this for free. How would you feel if someone stole your stuff?
It's funny too, because they say that they respect the artist and they care about the artist and they want, you know, they want to support the artist, but you really can't. if you're providing absolutely nothing into the system that helps create the art that you're enjoying, I mean, you are just a leech. And I've seen some of the Scanlation kids claim that, oh, well, the artist doesn't, he's not doing it for the money. Like, they're just making shit up. Like, they're just making motivations that don't exist to justify piracy. But that's not why, Scanlations are not why I wanted to have you on. I'm trying to overhaul the way we cover manga because it is so different. I've spent a lot of time looking at manga blogs and the way it's literary. It really is sort of literary criticism. They read like book reviews, as they should, because they are book reviews, but they're very different from anime. So, I mean, how do you approach a review? When you sit down to write a review, what's your thought process? What's your writing process like?
Well, usually I assume that the reader has never read the book.
Right.
So I try to give the way that About.com reviews are structured very, very straightforwardly. Like, you have to give pros and cons, one sentence pros and cons, and you give a sum up of your feelings. And then as far as the main body of the review goes, I usually spend like one or two paragraphs explaining the story, but I work very hard not to put spoilers in.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of giving you the framework of what the story's about. Usually with my reviews, I have about maybe five to eight paragraphs.
Mm-hmm.
So I usually use like one or two paragraphs to explain the story, the thrust, the main thrust of the plot, without giving away spoilers, because I work really hard to not give away spoilers,
mm-hmm.
Not rehash the whole plot, but just enough to kind of entice you.
Right.
And then I usually spend like the next couple of paragraphs explaining what I like about the art, what I like about the storytelling, or don't like.
Mm-hmm.
Is it clear to me what's going on? Is it? And then, sometimes I try to, frame it like, is it just me and my taste, or is it something that you would like if you were not me?
Right, sort of an attempt at objectivity. Moving forward, what kind of stuff do you personally like gravitate towards? Because I mean, I'm only really recently starting to pick up a lot of manga and getting into it, and I'm finding myself gravitating towards the Viz Signature, the Sigiki stuff.
For sure, yeah.
Yeah, is that sort of what you're into? What kind of stuff do you like?
That kind of tends to be on the realm of the stuff that really moves me, because that's the stuff that where you have stories and artists who are really doing something innovative,
mm-hmm.
and very personal, or a very just very distinctive style. Real kind of sophisticated.
Yeah.
And that's, that's seinen stuff. And that's, and that's for people who are maybe in their 20s who like manga and, appreciate it as an art form. But I do love shoujo manga, like with a weird passion. Because
uh-huh.
I grew up with that. So I appreciate that kind of art form. The one manga I have a really hard time with is real fan service-y shonen stuff.
Yeah.
But, that's because, I can appreciate great art and I appreciate good storytelling, but if it's just predictable and boring,
yeah,
then I have a hard time with it.
Super formulaic. I wonder if that's the connection, because a lot of that seinen stuff, it is more sophisticated because it's aimed at a much older audience. It's,
right.
And as a result, the critique and the sorts of people who critique that kind of thing tend to be more sophisticated people, right. Or just with more sophisticated tastes, or have a more mature attitude towards reviewing things. And I wonder if that's where the disconnection is between manga critics and anime critics, is because the stuff that tends to get turned into anime is the predictable shonen stuff and the fan service stuff. And that's not a knock on anime. It's just that might be where the difference is. That might be where the gulf is between a good manga critic and a good anime critic, because you have to appreciate almost two completely different things.
It's for two different audiences, honestly. I mean, a lot of anime is geared towards a younger audience.
Most of it is, yeah.
Yeah, and it's a TV show, and a lot of times with like some of the best seinen stuff, is there's a subtlety that is really can't be captured in a 24-minute animated episode.
Right.
So that you're talking like the difference between watching, say, your average episode of Bleach, mm-hmm. versus watching Paprika.
Yeah. Right.
And that's kind of what you're dealing with here.
That's a big difference. When it comes to covering stuff, you mentioned there's this ocean of titles out there. What do you think? Do you think it's more important to focus on the stuff that, I mean, what should the critic focus on? How should they tackle that ocean?
I guess just whatever you're passionate about, whatever you feel. Like, I try to look at it like, if I read something and I immediately want to run to my friend, you have to read this.
Mm-hmm.
This is so effing awesome.
Yeah.
And then, or if I think it does something special and interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Like, for example, I recently reviewed Deka Kyoshi, mm-hmm. which was from CMX Manga. And it surprised me because it wasn't what I thought it was going to be. I thought it was going to be about a you know, kindergarten cop and this kid who can see monsters. And it ended up being much more about, you know, tweens and teens having these really deep problems that this teacher and this kid helps them solve, like, you know, risk cutting and shoplifting. And, you know, so it was like kind of like a kiddie version of GTO, Great Teacher Onizuka.
Mm-hmm.
And that kind of surprised me. So I thought, oh, I have to write about this because it wasn't what I expected. And I suspect other people felt the same.
So the critic basically should just dive in and pick the stuff that they actually personally like. Because with anime, we review what gets sent to us.
Yeah.
And with manga, it sounds like you have to request the books from the publisher. They don't just send you everything.
Yeah. It really, really depends. It took me about a year and a half to get on most publishers' lists.
Yeah, we're on the lists. They generally, I've noticed the publishers do not send anything past volume one. Everything after that, you got to request it, which I'm not used to as an anime guy. You know, they'll just send me the stuff and I'll send it out to my critics. But with manga, it sounds like you really have to maintain those relationships with the publisher.
Yeah, I do.
Now, have you experienced anything where they sort of play favorites, where they'll cut you off if you trash their product? Does that exist in the manga sphere?
Not that I've seen, no. you know, like they won't send, like, for example, Digital Manga Publishing.
Yeah.
I have a fairly good relationship with them as, you know, friends and colleagues and whatever. But they know that I don't review a whole lot of boys' love.
Mm-hmm.
So they don't send me a whole lot. And so that's fine with me because, you know, I'd rather, I understand their point of view.
Oh, so speaking of the boys' love stuff and the yaoi genre. Now, it seems like you sort of need a specialized critic to cover those things.
I think you really do.
Unfortunately, we just lost our specialized critic, Casey.
Yeah, but you know, they're out there. There's a lot of, if you put a call out there, there are people who are really passionate and really knowledgeable
mm-hmm.
about it and can really speak to fans who for what people they look for in that genre.
And see, for me, there's a conundrum there because I wouldn't hire a critic who had such an obvious bias towards a certain genre. Normally, you wouldn't want that in a critic. You would want someone who's open to everything, but it sounds like it's such a specialized thing that you have to have someone who is just focused on that genre in order to tell people what's good and what's bad. Otherwise, the critic might focus too much on the fact that it's yaoi. Like, they sort of have to throw that out.
Yeah, you don't want someone who just goes, ew, boys.
Right, well, yeah, obviously. I wouldn't hire someone like that, but that's interesting. So,
Someone already has gone over that threshold and just accepts that this is about boys, loving boys, and there's some tropes going on.
Right. Yeah. I only recently had started being exposed to yuri stuff.
Yeah,
I watched Sasameki Koto, which turned into total garbage after like an episode or two. But I realized that I'm so inexperienced with those genres, I could never write a proper review of it because I don't have the experience. So it sounds like for those genres in particular, you really do need a specialist. So I guess I'm going to have to bring on a couple of folks.
I think it's okay to sometimes have someone who just likes manga and is halfway knowledgeable about yaoi, but is not like this rah-rah, yaoi is the best no matter what.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
You don't want...
There's some stuff that's just horrible.
Yeah, exactly. You don't want someone who just likes everything. That's not a critic. That's someone writing product descriptions. So what's your take on the publishers? Who's doing it best? Who's not? You don't have to rip on anybody, but who do you think is doing like the best job out there right now of the publishers that are out?
Well, I mean, obviously, I think Yen Press really has a finger on what fans are really looking for.
Mm-hmm.
I think they have a great relationship with their fans. When you see them at the cons, they have a wonderful rapport. Also, I think Viz maybe has just buckets of quality manga to choose from
mm-hmm.
with Shueisha and with their relationship with Shueisha and Shogakukan.
Mm-hmm.
And I love that they have the budget and the means to put out very high quality editions. Like, have you seen Go-Go Monster? Oh my God, that's just gorgeous.
I have not yet, but I just bought, last thing I bought from them was Children of the Sea, which was really nicely.
Really nice, right? Yeah. I mean, they put my major in college was graphic design.
Mm-hmm.
So I appreciate all the little details, the French folds, I guess, you know, the little details in the embossing and so on.
Yeah. It was just a nicely produced book. Now, with Yen Press, I've noticed I never see coverage of their stuff. People don't seem to talk much about what they have. They publish an anthology. I never hear anything about it. Now, you said they had a great relationship with the fans. but I almost never see coverage of their stuff online. So I'm wondering, have you noticed that? Is that, I mean, why do you think that is?
Not, I mean, I guess I didn't notice that until you mentioned that, really. just because, I mean, some of their stuff, I mean, speaking for myself personally, is a lot of their Japanese stuff comes from Square Enix.
Yeah.
And that's very fanny.
Yeah.
So like, to speak.
Yeah.
So if unless you get Soul Eater, you won't get Soul Eater.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know, unless you're on board with not what's going on in Nabarino, you're not gonna get Nabarino.
Yeah.
But you know, I think they got the cream of the crop as far as what Square Enix is putting out. You know what I mean? Black Butler, that's really lovely stuff.
Yeah, yeah. I've seen a little bit of the anime for that. It was very pretty.
Yeah, and then also the art's just really nice. It's I guess my difference with, you know, anime and manga is that when I read the manga, I can see the touch of the artist.
Oh, absolutely. You know, it's a huge difference, too, because, like, one of my favorites is Hellsing. And the artwork in the comics is nigh on psychedelic. I mean, it's insane. And it will not translate to animation unless you have a gigantic budget and people dedicated to bringing that style to life. But it functions as a static image much more than it does in animation. And I noticed that with a lot of things. I mean, even something like One Piece, the artwork in the manga, it sort of gets a little bit toned down and sort of generic, you know, made a little generic so it can be animated on the cheap, you know,
once
a week. So there is that really strong value to having the graphic novel version of it, because you really do connect with the artist and their artwork.
Right.
So that,
like, if you look at, like, Emma, for example, like, if you look at the anime version of Emma and the manga version of Emma,
yeah,
the manga version of Emma has beauty, subtlety, and detail.
Yeah.
Like, so much of the story gets told just by these stolen glances.
Yeah.
And these subtleties in the facial expressions that I just saw was completely missing in the anime.
Yeah, yeah, right. Yeah. Well, and again, because that's a show they had to produce on the cheap. You know, and it's similar with Aria. Now, Aria, the cartoon, is like the most boring thing I have ever seen. It is so boring. It is willfully boring. It's trying to be really boring. And that's because right. And that's because the comics are boring, but the comics are way less boring because it's just a single panel of a still shot of Venetian waterways. It's just one panel. It's not 10 minutes.
Right.
So,
I mean, for example, like, Yotsuba is not made into anime. And I'm glad it's not.
That's got to be coming, though.
No way. I hope he doesn't, because his comic timing in the manga is pitch perfect.
Yeah. I responded much better to the comic version of Azumanga Daioh than I did to the anime. Like, much better. I thought the comics were actually clever and worthwhile and funny. The anime, I thought, was obnoxious. there is sort of a huge difference there. The critics really have to be a different mindset. I mean, I wonder if you can have a manga critic who's a good anime critic and an anime critic who's a good manga critic, like, if that doesn't go both ways, I wonder.
I have to wonder, because I've seen people who can do both, but, you know.
I mean, I think Carlos Santos does a good job. Obviously, I keep him hired. but his reviews of anime are good. They're solid. They're as good as his manga reviews. But I guess that's a pretty rare trait, because a lot of my other critics, they just straight up don't read manga. And it doesn't get sent to them. And so it's not part of their repertoire. But it's just fascinating to me that there's that rift, because it never occurred to me until the last couple of years that these are two very different styles of criticism. People want different things.
You both. I'm shocked too.
Yeah. So I'm going to go ahead and get to the Twitter questions. Oh, before we get to Twitter questions, I just wanted to know, do you have any advice for me moving into the world of sort of hardcore manga criticism and coverage? Any tips?
I would say, you know, like I'm usually side by side with your reporters at the cons, reporting on licenses.
Mm-hmm.
And I know, you know, a lot of your reporting is just, here's the titles, here's what's behind, here's what's coming out, bam.
Yep.
And it's out the door in seconds.
Yeah.
I tend to spend more time looking up the titles and getting a synopsis.
Well, we kind of have to be first out of the gate. That's
and that's good. But I'm just saying that, you know, if you could follow up with that and get people excited about the title, because not everyone will know what it means, like title and name.
Yeah, actually, we've had that problem before, where I'm sitting in a room covering a Viz panel, and I don't know what half the stuff they're announcing is. So it winds up going out flawed because I have no idea what they're talking about. So maybe when I bring on some manga people who are, you know, much better versed in that, I can start sending them to those panels, and they might already know what these people are talking about.
Yeah, I mean, you know, why you should be excited, like, oh, this is by this artist who also did this before that you might be familiar with.
Yeah, or yeah.
That's, even that.
That's always good. It's always good when you can connect it back. It's kind of what the encyclopedia is for, though. Okay, so let's get to the Twitter questions. We got a couple here.
Okay.
From Curiosity, who writes her own blog over at curiosity.com with a K. I'm curious to know if or how Deb would do things differently as a manga blogger if she didn't write as a part of about.com.
I'd swear a lot more. I'd probably be a little more rambling, I suppose, because about.com is very formatted.
Yeah.
As far as our reviews go, I sometimes I deeply envy reviewers who can write paragraph upon paragraph upon paragraph about a series and get really deeply into it.
Mm-hmm.
I have a limit of 8 paragraphs.
Oh, really?
And I got to make them all count.
You can't do more than that?
I could do, I mean, I can do longer reviews about a whole series and go on and on and on. But, you know, I used to bemoan that, but now I think it's actually good. Because
I would say so.
I think it's tighter.
Those 2,000-word reviews, I almost never get through especially if it's about, like, volume 3 of something.
Could you possibly have
2,000 words to say about volume 3 of something?
I like the discipline, and, you know, I've learned to appreciate the discipline of having
It's funny when you write, because I have, you know, word limits and stuff like that on Anna, and it we're fairly consistent. And I think when you work for a professional site, now is that your full time job?
No, actually, this is my extra fun.
Oh, this is your hobby. Okay, but you do it for a professional website.
Yes.
It's not just a personal blog. It's not just something you do.
It's something I had to audition for, believe it or not.
Right. Yeah, I'm sure the chains that are on you when you work for a professional site or a site that's paying you or a site where you're invested in it, the restraints are good. They're the blogs that actually show restraint are the best blogs. The guys that don't self-indulge to the point of writing, you know, 3,000 words on something. I think the restraints are definitely a good thing and shows discipline.
I think so.
I mean, the freedom is great, mm-hmm. but you do have to appeal to an audience. From Lorebits, what do you think the future of OEL Global Manga will be like?
Well, that's an interesting question because I just got back from Comedia, which is, it's like a quarterly show of independent manga artists.
Yeah, you got to hang out with our buddy Evan Miller.
Yes, that was awesome. Or Evan showed us to the street.
I affectionately refer to him as Miller Coon.
That was fun, actually, because we had a great group with us. Lenny Liu was with us, Svetlana Chimakova, Becky Coonan.
Right, Svetlana is sort of the superstar of that world, right?
It was actually really fun because we did our own little anthology book.
Oh, yeah.
That was translated to Japanese, and we sold it there.
Yeah.
And we met a lot of really, you know, interesting people, and we walked around, and I introduced them to several artists that I thought had really interesting work. And I was talking with some of the people who, you know, have their feet in both worlds, like, say, Aki Yanagi, for example. He works with Marvel a lot. And they're basically, the consensus is most manga artists and most manga readers in Japan really don't care about OEL manga.
Right.
Because,
same
quote,
in America.
Yeah, you know, because, quote, they're too busy reading Japanese manga.
Yeah.
So I guess, you know, it's kind of humbling in a way because you realize that it's a very one-sided love.
Right.
But Aki was mentioning, that while the readers are not there for this, the editors are becoming interested.
Really?
So editors like, I'd say, Iki and, say, Morning are starting to be interested in it. But they're interested in a very specific type of OEL manga that has something different to say, has a different point of view, different art style. Because they're not interested in anything that's purely duplicative of what's made in Japan. Because
right,
they can get it there and get it better.
I guess that sort of explains why Felipe Smith is doing what he's doing. Because I've seen his comic, is it Pipo Chu or Pipo Cho?
Pipo Chu?
Yeah, I can never get that name right. But that doesn't look like any OEL manga I've seen published over here.
Yeah, yeah. You can see a manga influence, but that is definitely, you could look at his artwork from, like, you know, several feet away, not mistake it for anyone else.
Yeah.
That's what they're looking for.
Yeah, and it's great to see that, because I was kind of down on Felipe because I really didn't like MBQ when that came out. And it's nice to see it now that he can sort of spread his wings and really show off what he can do. Because in the sort of the bad old days when Tokyo Pop was really exploiting the shit out of the OEL stuff, they produced so much garbage. I don't know if you ever got around to reading any of that stuff, but man, I mean, it was bad.
But you can kind of see the difference, right? Because when you see Felipe now,
yeah,
he's working very closely with Japanese editors.
Well, yeah, and you got to question I'm sure these people don't work there anymore and they won't listen to this, but you got to question the levels of quality that the Japanese editors are expecting is probably vastly different from what the Tokyo Pop people were asking for.
Sure, sure. There was actually at Comedia, they had portfolio reviews.
Yeah.
They had this whole section where like editors from Jump Square and like G Fantasy were there talking with artists and reviewing their portfolios actively. The interesting thing about Comedia is that it is all artists. There's right. no big booths with like video games or toys or anything like that. Mm-hmm. It's just 2,000 tables of artists.
And there's not a lot of doujinshi there, right?
No, actually, that's the key difference of Comedia is that it's all original work. So no slash, nice. No fan art, and no cosplay.
Wow, nice.
Yeah, so I mean, it was what's kind of tricky about Comedia is that you'll get like this thick book with pictures and of the artist. A yeah. lot of times, all they'll do is they'll put just their circle name, not their pen name.
Really?
So I mean, I had to walk through the halls, and you know, thanks to Ryan from Same Hat, I found Shintaro Kago and bought original art from him. I found Est-M, who does Red Blinds of Foolish, and she does beautiful, beautiful work. Range Murata, who does Robot.
I know,
just crazy, amazing professional artists. I mean, you know, some people who are pure amateurs to these utterly polished professionals. But if I looked at that guidebook, given my limited grasp of kanji, I wouldn't know that these people were here.
Wow.
Where, chill, I had to walk, look at their work, recognize it, ask him, is that your name? and I go, holy shit, I totally do the American, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God.
Yeah. Yeah, I try not to do that at Comic-Con too much, but I catch myself sometimes. Okay, well, that's about it. Obviously, we've barely scratched the surface of this topic, and I really appreciate you helping me out. I certainly need all the guidance I have if I'm going to start wading into the testy waters of manga criticism. But before I let you go, I did want to ask you, do you have any recommendations, books people should read that are out now?
Wow. Recently, what's in my stack? I'm loving Moyashimon, if you haven't already picked it up.
I haven't read it yet, but I've got it on my stack.
Completely hilarious and bizarrely educational.
Now, is that on shelves now? Because I know it got recalled, right?
Yes, it is. Actually, it just got released this past week.
Okay.
Officially, yeah. Go-Go Monster, which I mentioned earlier. It's a single volume by Taiyo Matsumoto.
Yeah.
He did Tekkon Kinkreet. It's utterly hypnotic.
Oh, really? Tekkon Kinkreet.
Crazy.
Now, that was great. Now, talk about this one
because it's... Yeah. It's, from beginning to end, it's a piece of art.
Wow.
It just sucks you in with this kind of subtle suspense.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a little vague in a way, but it's just utterly original.
Yeah,
you won't forget it.
You want to talk about something that works as a manga and not as an anime? Tekkon Kinkreet.
yeah, I hear you.
Anything else?
I'm also reading The Art of Osamu Tezuka. That's a coffee table book by Helen McCarthy.
Yep, Helen McCarthy strikes again.
Beautiful, beautiful book. Really fills in a lot of blanks about Tezuka. And Red Snow. That's a Susumu Katsumata. Mm-hmm. It's a Gekika title from Drawn and Quarterly.
Okay.
Really neat. It's like a kind of like folk tales, but very dark and kind of adult. There's a lot of very matter-of-fact sex in there. That kind of threw me off. It's like your grandpa telling you these fables, but like, and then there's the sexy part. Like, whoa.
Well, thanks. I'm running to the bookstore right now.
Yeah, you got to go check this one out because it's really good.
Okay, Deb, thank you so much for being on the show, and we will see you all next week.